This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1999, Chechen fighters entered Russia's Dagestan region and declared it an independent state. Russia retaliated in Chechnya in what's known as the Second Chechen War. Officially, Russians called it a counterterrorism operation. It was supposed to be brief and victorious. By October 1999, then Prime Minister Vladimir Putin ordered the complete takeover of the Chechen capital of Grozny. From December 1999 to February 2000, the Russian military laid siege to Grozny. Putin vowed that the military would not stop bombing Grozny until Russian troops, quote, fulfilled their task to the end. They finished in February 2000, when the BBC's Andrew Harding stepped foot into Grozny, a place the UN declared the most destroyed city on Earth.
Lords of the rubble, Russian troops drive into Grozny, the city they destroyed in order to capture. In the suburbs, we saw mile after mile of total devastation. Not a single house or cottage intact. Giant craters everywhere. Most streets are still too dangerous to walk down. Thousands of mines and booby traps have been discovered by Russian troops, not always intentionally.
This is unreal. It's like walking through a World War II film set. This was the centre of Grozny. These were 12, 15-storey apartment blocks. Now there is nothing left here.
The BBC's Andrew Harding in Grozny 22 years ago. And he joins us now. Andrew, welcome. What else did you see when you walked into Grozny, or what was left of Grozny, that day in February 2000?
Hi, Meghna. Gosh, it's chilling to hear that, and obviously in the context of Ukraine, to be taken back to those horrific days in Grozny. I remember the people scuttling around, the civilians who'd dared to stay on, who had no option but to stay on, trapped in the rubble. I visited families who were in their cellars, who'd been living in their cellars for months under the bombardment that, I mean, didn't just destroy city blocks or parts of a city. This was an oil town, a prosperous oil town of 500,000 people, and it was flattened totally, block by block, ruthlessly, efficiently, deliberately, with every single weapon short of nuclear that the former Soviet army had.
Flattened. I mean, if I have your career here correct in front of me, Andrew, you've been covering, you've been a correspondent for the BBC for some 30 years, but Chechnya was the first war you had covered?
It was the first war, and to be honest, nothing since in the 20-something conflicts I've covered since, nothing's ever come close to that. And I think that's the same for a lot of my colleagues. You know, we still talk about those days just with shock that it could ever have happened, that we were living through essentially a Stalingrad of horrific proportions. Of course, there were two wars, the Putin's war from 99 to 2000, when journalists were effectively barred from getting in, very difficult to access. Also, people were out to kill us as journalists. There was a price on our head. Gangsters were trying to kidnap us. Myself was kidnapped once briefly. People were trying to execute us as well. Journalists had their heads cut off. It was terrifying. But the first war in many ways was even more scary.
The first war in the early 90s, the first Chechen war.
Exactly. This is what started it all. A much more chaotic start to a much more chaotic conflict. The second war that Putin started was much more ruthless, much more intentional, if you might say. But Yeltsin, Boris Yeltsin, the former president, who started a war in 1994, really slid into a war that could easily have been avoided. But the same brutality that we witnessed up close, and I shall never forget walking through the rubble of Grozny in early in 1995 during a brief lull, and it still brings shivers to me just thinking about going and finding people in their basements, whole families living there, too scared to leave with us. I remember saying, we've got to go. The fighting, the shooting's going to start again soon, and these families just too terrified to leave. And I remember on our way out being cluster bombed by the Russian Air Force, these huge explosions overhead, then these tiny small bomblets coming down onto the ground, shooting out arrows in all directions, mowing down everybody. These are the sort of weapons they were using. And we dived for cover behind anything concrete. And those who weren't quick enough were torn to shreds. It was absolutely horrific.
So the first Chechen War, the Chechens had essentially declared independence. Russia retaliated. It was, as you said, it was a horrific war in the early and mid 90s that ended in something in a stalemate. Essentially, Vladimir Putin witnessed that. He wasn't yet prime minister, but is it fair to say that the stalemate ending to the in the devastation of the first Chechen War set up Putin's desire to finish the job, for the lack of a better phrase, in 1999, when he became prime minister of Russia?
Exactly. The Chechen rebels, who number just a few thousand, 4,000 or 5,000, very battle-hardened, very determined, fearless fighters operating on foot largely in small groups, they brought to its knees a superpower army that had vast conscript legions at its disposal, a huge armory, helicopter gunships, MiG fighter planes. But this small determined group brought that military to a stop, basically said, you can capture towns, you can destroy the country, but you can't defeat us. And the Russians eventually admitted that, signed a kind of peace deal, allowed the Chechens to have elections in which the Chechen military commander, a man called Aslan Maskhadov, actually won the election. And for a time, it seemed as if some sort of sanity, some kind of deal could prevail. But unfortunately, Chechnya slipped back into chaos. And then in 1999, you had a series of extraordinary attacks blamed on the Chechens, some of them clearly the responsibility of the Chechens, attacking neighboring countries. But you also had apartment bombings far from Chechnya. And I remember walking through the rubble of apartments that had been blown up suddenly in Moscow in, I think, September 1999. And what's so chilling about those apartment bombings was that they became the pretext for the second war, for Vladimir Putin's war on Chechnya, as you say, to get the job done there, to crush the Chechens. But there is strong circumstantial evidence that it was Vladimir Putin and his own security services that were actually responsible for those bombs, blowing up their own people to create the pretext for another war.
What was called a counterterrorism operation, right, at the time in 1999. It seems critical to understand that, you know, in the first Chechen War in the mid-90s, this was Russia as immediately post-Soviet Russia, right? So the military had been the Great Red Army before that. And then, as you note, in the first Chechen War, it's essentially humiliated by this ragtag bunch of rebels that managed to stop the Russian army or at least force them into a stalemate. How important is it to understand that perhaps unwillingness to be humiliated again that Putin had in 1999 when he ordered, I mean, the complete destruction, as you describe, of Grozny in 1999 that led to the deaths of so many. How important is it to understand that as we, I mean, you yourself on Twitter, Andrew, recently said that what you're seeing in Ukraine has strong echoes of what you saw in Chechnya.
Huge echoes. I mean, I remember actually being asked by the Chechens to take out Russian POWs that the Chechens had captured, but they couldn't deal with. There were just so many young conscripts absolutely scared out of their wits, surrendering everywhere. And we've seen suggestions, at least, of that in Ukraine already. These young conscripts sent into battle with barely any equipment, no real idea where they were going, what they were doing, cannon fodder. And that was part of this sense of Russia's humiliation. Of course, it was in the context of economic collapse since 1991, of gangsterism taking over the economy, of a country that had lost its way and saw the import of American culture, American goods, that felt it was being humiliated. And different parts of the Russian state took different lessons from that. Some people said, the answer is democracy. We need to accelerate democratic reforms. We need to embrace Europe. We need to move it out that direction. But the colder, harder people like Vladimir Putin focused on the humiliation, felt that it was deliberate, then looked at NATO's gradual expansion and saw this as the West seeking to humiliate Russia, rather than Russia and the Soviet Union being the architects of their own collapse. And that really, I think, has fueled people like Putin so strongly.
The totality, of civilian deaths between the two Chechen wars, what, I'm seeing numbers anywhere from 30,000 to perhaps more than 100,000. Do you think, Andrew, can we fairly say that that gives us any indication of how far Vladimir Putin may be willing to go in Ukraine?
I don't know, but I fear so. Chechnya was a very different war. The Chechens had been demonized for years. There's a sort of racism against the darker skinned people of the Caucasus that was exploited and whipped up. And this was part of Russia's own territory. Mm. Ukraine, much more complicated, but Putin's created his own narrative around that, that we've heard so much about reclaiming original Russian territory. Kiev, you know, deeply precious to Russia's sense of itself and its history. Hard to imagine the Russian military razing all that architecture, all that history, all those churches to the ground. And yet, if this war continues in the way it's continuing, what happens inevitably is that the generals who've been ordered to seize a capital, if their troops aren't willing to fight or aren't able to fight on the ground successfully, what do? You turn to the weapons that will work, that will deliver you the city, even if what you hand to Putin is a victory that is pure rubble. So, you know, there is in Chechnya a horrific precedent for that.
Andrew Harding, he's been a correspondent with the BBC for 30 years, currently the BBC's Africa correspondent. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrew.
Thank you.
More in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about what happened to the Chechen capital of Grozny more than 20 years ago, across two so-called Chechen wars, what the Russian military did there, and what it tells us about what Vladimir Putin and the Russian military may be willing to do now in Ukraine. Well, Thomas Dvorak is a photojournalist with the famed Magnum Group. He was just 19 years old when he covered the first Chechen war, beginning in 1991. He stayed working in the region for two decades. Though his award-winning eye and camera have documented wars around the world since then, Dvorak says he's never seen anything quite like what he witnessed in Chechnya.
There was these abandoned people erring around in the middle of this. You would walk around Grozny. It was incredibly eerie. It was very, and both wars equally. I don't say the first one worse than the second one. And and you come across people who sort of, they look for something. They look for some food. They're not even really trying to get out. They're just sort of coming out because they've been. I mean, I remember meeting somebody who was in a bunker for 4 weeks or 3.5 weeks who hadn't been out and just wanted to get fresh light and air. And then they go back into their basements.
During the second Chechen War, in late January, early February of 2000, Dvorak was one of only a handful of journalists, perhaps the only one, at the outskirts of Grozny when he documented Russia's final takeover of the city and the fleeing shadows of the entire Chechen resistance.
The fighters said that the Chechens had given up, had decided to abandon the city. So they had this relatively organized exit, and It was by chance. I was in the village on the outskirts of Grozny, and I walked back into towards Grozny because this was the opening, the only opening in the... We were surrounded, and Grozny was encircled, and they, because they walked and it was a minefield, so quite a lot of them blew up or got injured in mines. There was constantly, you could constantly hear the popping of like mines going off. So only in the cover of darkness they would come out, and you could only see the silhouettes of them walking and like this column of men and carrying like injured people and everything. And it took a few pictures, of course, but it was like, and then I had this little window before it was light, because then they had to hide.
Award-winning photojournalist Thomas Dworzak. Well, Michael Kaufman joins us now. He's director of Russia Studies at the Center for Naval Analysis, a nonprofit research and analysis organization, and also author of a blog called Russia Military Analysis. Michael Kaufman, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on your program.
So, first of all, talk to me about the past 5 days in Ukraine. Does it have any echoes of, let's start with the first Chechen war?
It does. It actually has echoes of both conflicts. I think the first 48 hours of the Russian military campaign show a tremendous political miscalculation, a belief that they could go for the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, and quickly introduce airborne forces and get a surrender. Essentially, they grossly misjudged the likelihood of Ukrainian resistance in the early hours of the campaign. And it has strong echoes of, you know, some of the Russian sentiments going into Grozny in 1994, particularly, you know, the sort of infamous phrase or quote by Pavel Grachev, then Minister of Defense, who cavalierly quipped that a Russian airborne regiment could take Grozny in 2 hours. And of course, the initial assault on Grozny was an absolute disaster.
So tell me more for people who don't recall that history. What made it such a disaster?
You know, in 94, Russian forces really believed that, or at least the Russian military, that with a strong show of force, four armored columns trying to penetrate the center of the city, that they could quickly intimidate Chechens and that they could get them to surrender. They didn't systematically encircle the city. They went in there, and it was a brutal fight, where a host of Russian armored vehicles were taken out. Many Russian units were lost. The initial assault was frankly a disaster. And then it led to a prolonged and bloody campaign. But it was clear from the initial fighting that grossly misjudged the ability and the will of Chechen fighters occupying Grozny to resist. And of course, the Russian force back then was quite different, too. It was largely a force cobbled together of conscripts who themselves were fairly inexperienced and not well organized for the campaign.
So underestimating the resistance that the Russian military would meet, that's clearly it seems one of the first strong echoes that we're seeing in Ukraine.
Absolutely. It's very clear the Russian political leadership actually believes the things that they say. That is, they thought that there would be fairly low resistance. The initial Russian campaign in the first couple of days appeared to be an attempt at, you know, what we call thunder runs, which is basically try to push forces very rapidly down roads to seize junctions, avoid major cities, avoid main fighting. They didn't think that Ukrainian forces would seriously resist. And they tried to get to the capital very quickly. I think they believed that they could get Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, to surrender. And I mean surrender in a matter of days. You know, Kyiv is in this very large city. It's a city of 3 million people. And their plan is completely unrealistic in the opening hours, at least from my point of view. But it's clearly what they attempted. Now, since then, there have been very visible adjustments to the Russian operation.
So we'll talk about those adjustments in a moment, Michael. But, I mean, Ukraine is obviously, there are many differences, profound differences between Ukraine and Chechnya. It sort of almost defies my imagination to think that Putin and the advisors around him would presume that rolling deep into Ukraine would lead to sort of almost an instantaneous laying down of arms by the Ukrainian people and their military. I mean, I can't quite understand that.
Yeah, it sounds incredibly delusional, but I will tell you that if you look at the opening of this military operation, the Russian military is not organized or fighting the way it normally would. It's not using most of its capabilities, and very little of Russian military power has actually been committed to the fight. In fact, they've just been sending, in the first hours, small units, detachments, down roads. The effort is shambolic. It is disorganized. It's very clear, in fact, that unlike in the first two Chechen wars, Russian forces weren't really told that they were going to conduct a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. That is, they probably didn't realize themselves until the last days when they were pushed to the border. It's clear from Russian soldiers, at least those I've seen interviewed, that they had no idea. They had very little notion that they were going to conduct a large-scale military operation. So the early parts of this effort on the Russian side look somewhat disastrous, at least from my point of view.
So then tell me about what may happen next. And let's go back again to history, because the end of the first, I put end in quotes, right, because it wasn't really an end at the first of the first Chechen war, that so-called stalemate I had been talking with Andrew Harding about before. What happened right before that? Because it seems as if that same sort of somewhat shambolic start that you're describing in Ukraine, we saw in Chechnya in the early 1990s. But then the Russian military really regrouped and dug in and destroyed Grozny even in the first Chechen war.
They did, but the campaign in general wasn't a successful one. They were ultimately successful in taking Grozny, but resistance continued from Chechen fighters, both around the city and the countryside. And it was a deeply unpopular war. The Russian political leadership was trying to fight this war with a cobbled together force of various types of troops that were inexperienced. Many of them didn't work together very well. And ultimately, the accord they signed was one resultant of stalemate, but fundamentally a political defeat for Russia and for the Russian political objectives in that conflict.
So that's the possibility of a similar outcome sounds, I don't want to say likely, but the political defeat for Russia has to be on Putin's mind right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other side of that equation, though, is that given the immense political and economic pressure Russia's under right now, resulting from the sanctions, I think his decision is economically catastrophic for Russia. I'm not sure that he can afford to lose this war. In fact, maybe later on we can discuss that. I think he's going into more of a 1999 style campaign in Chechnya following this, where the second war might prove to be far more analogous as to how this proceeds, whereas the first one is more useful as to how the conflict started.
So let's talk about that right now, right? Because the second one, that 1999 analogy that we started the hour with Andrew Harding, I mean, Andrew described a hellscape, to put it lightly, of what was left of Grozny by February 2000. So tell me, Michael Kaufman, why do you think that we should be focusing on what happened with Russia and Chechnya in the second Chechen war?
So it's clear the Russian political leadership still sees the Ukrainian capital as the center of gravity. They want to get the political leadership of Ukraine to capitulate. And now you see a mass of Russian forces, of battalions, on their way in two pincer movements from the northwest and the northeast towards the capital, which is actually not dissimilar from the Russian campaign plan for the Battle of Grozny in 1999. The big differences we saw were that Russian forces so far haven't really used air power. And even though they've been shelling cities like Kharkiv extensively, most Russian firepower has still been on the sidelines of this conflict. But very quickly, we're beginning to see that change. And 1999-2000s, you know, the Russian approach in the campaign to Grozny was much more systematic, encircling the city and then using heavy firepower and air power to level entire city blocks in order to enable a slow advance of Russian forces into the city itself. It was essentially the complete opposite of the 1994-95 campaign. And the Russian decision was, well, urban combat is hellish, It consumes entire armies. It strongly favors the defender. And the Russian solution was simply to level large parts of the city. And whenever they, you know, the Russian forces had contact with Chechen fighters, they'd call an artillery or they'd call in airstrikes.
Were civilians given the opportunity, ample and sufficient opportunity, to leave Grozny before those airstrikes were called in?
So Russians did create a corridor for civilians to try to try to exit and to get them to exit. I think that we're probably seeing in the slowness of the Russian approach to Kyiv right now, both logistical issues, the sheer logistical constraints of trying to move in that amount of manpower and material, but also I suspect they're holding off a bit because they want to see part of the city de facto depopulated, right? It's a large city, and they want to see probably civilians leave to make an assault even easier for themselves.
So tell me more, though, about what you've been seeing in the past, let's say, 48 hours, about what's happening with the Russian military in Ukraine, because I understand that you think that it's very likely that we will see more destructive urban warfare rather soon.
Absolutely. It's already been taking place. I mean, we've seen Russian forces engage in urban combat in a number of towns. There are Ukrainian forces fighting back. There are Ukrainian territorial units and territorial brigades trying to fight back and resist. And even in the Ukrainian capital, you see strong echoes of sort of 1999. Within 48 hours almost, Russian forces had already sent reconnaissance units in to engage Ukrainian defenders and try to figure out their positions and the extent to which the city was defended by essentially almost a third day. And now, almost similar to 99 as well, You've seen heavy fighting on the outskirts of Kyiv in a couple of towns where there have been pitched battles as forward elements of the Russian military, again, the Russian airborne, have engaged in heavy urban combat with the Ukrainian armed forces.
Okay. So it's hard to understand. I mean, obviously, I'm not a military analyst. So help me understand, Michael, if you could. Is there a difference between, in terms of outcome, between what I've been hearing some people say, that like this first week for Putin has gone so badly that he may be backed into a corner and therefore will escalate in order to win the war that you just said he cannot afford to lose? Or is this what you're seeing is sort of they're just waiting to still see if Ukraine might back down, and if they do not, then they would bring in that heavy air power to start truly, waging a more physically devastating war in Ukraine. Now, I know that, you know, the causes may not matter, the outcome may be the same, but it feels like it's important to understand what you're seeing and which path you think Russia might go down.
Well, to me, it looks like right now they're trickling more forces to try to resource what is ultimately, from my point of view, a failed strategy. I think that their main judgment on which way this conflict is going will be based around the extent to which they can successfully assault the Ukrainian capital or get the Ukrainian political leadership to make serious compromises, which would, in effect, I think, given Russia's maximalist war aims here, be a capitulation. I think it's a very unlikely outcome. My view is that as unsuccessful as the initial military operation has been, it is true, though, that they have been able to capture a number of smaller towns and have a breakout both in the south from Crimea and in the northeast. So, unfortunately, we're making judgments very early on into a war. And in the first number of days, we're sort of seeing a terrible opening for Russian forces. But it's very difficult to predict which direction this conflict is going to take.
Yes. But nevertheless, I feel compelled to ask. I mean, because we're trying to extract the lessons from those two Chechen wars and what happened with Grozny, especially in 1999, do you think Putin would be capable of such destruction again in Kyiv?
You know, I think that he has consistently tried to portray Ukrainians as a sort of brotherly people to Russia. But the truth is that I think absolutely he is capable of it. And I think that when pressed against the wall, I believe that you're going to see the Russian military increasingly, and we already have some evidence of it, use heavy firepower, begin using multiple launch rocket systems against cities, which they've done in a number of cases, artillery, cluster munitions, and start trickling air power into the battlefield as well. So I'm personally looking at this, and I think that this war is going to get a lot uglier, and I think that the worst is likely yet to come.
Michael Kaufman, stand by. We'll have more in a minute. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just want to give you a quick heads up about what we'll be talking about tomorrow. We're actually going to take a quick look at AI and autonomous vehicles, specifically around the Tesla and the ethics of automated vehicles. Tesla, you'll recall, had to recall 50,000 vehicles last month to disable a feature that allowed its fully self-driving beta software to basically break the law. So we want to hear from you. Are you a Tesla owner, or do you own any kind of vehicle with a semi-automated driving capability? What's your experience of that behind the wheel? Do you trust the software? How do you feel about sharing the road, maybe in the near future, with automated vehicles or autonomous vehicles? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Three. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're taking a deep look at what Vladimir Putin's actions, specifically during the Second Chechen War in 1999, and his ordering of the razing of the city of Grozny, what that tells us about what Putin may be capable of now as the Russian military continues its invasion of Ukraine. I'm joined today by Michael Kaufman. He's director of Russia Studies at CNA, or the Center for Naval Analysis, and author of a blog called Russia Military Analysis. He's with us from Washington. And Michael, let's just listen briefly to what President Joe Biden said last night about Ukraine. He dedicated quite a bit of his State of the Union address to the issue in Ukraine. And here's a little bit of what Biden said regarding the fact that he believes Russia has met a formidable foe in the Ukrainian people.
6 days ago, Russia's Vladimir Putin sought to shake the very foundations of the free world, thinking he could make it bend to his menacing ways. But he badly miscalculated. He thought he could roll into Ukraine and the world would roll over. Instead, he met with a wall of strength he never anticipated or imagined. He met the Ukrainian people.
President Joe Biden last night in his State of the Union address. And by the way, a little later today in our podcast feed, in our On Point podcast feed, we're going to be giving you a special bonus feature. On Point News analyst Jack Beattie is going to be providing us with his major takeaways and analysis of what you heard in a rather interesting State of the Union address last night. So hop over to our podcast feed, subscribe, and you'll get access to Jack's analysis of Biden's State of the Union. Well, joining us now is Paul Stronsky. He's senior fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Paul, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me on your program.
So let me hear from you, sort of your take on our overall thesis here. You've heard Michael and earlier Andrew Harding talk about it. I mean, what kinds of lessons do you think we ought to be drawing from the Chechen wars regarding what Putin may be capable of in Ukraine now?
Well, I think a lot of what your previous guests have discussed, I think, makes a lot of sense. I think this is a war that has not gone as expected for Vladimir Putin. He truly believed, I think, that the Ukrainian people were not going to resist, and many of them might actually even welcome the Russian troops. And so while at the early days, they were very clear that they were going to try to do this in a limited fashion through targeting military and other strategic sites, we've already seen them as they struggle and as some Russian troops seem uncomfortable with the mission, falling away, that sort of strategy falling away and increasingly targeting the cities. I think, you know, we're most focused right now on Kharkiv and Kiev. But I think we also need to remember that the suburbs of these cities have already witnessed a lot of fighting, and some very small towns around the ports in the south have already been bombarded, including in civilian areas. So I think we're starting down a very troubling road, and I think it's a road we've seen, you know, before, not just in Chechnya, but we've seen similar things in Syria and through, you know, Russian history too. There's been a history of scorched earth campaigns as part of their war fighting machine. And so I think this is all very troubling.
Well, so I'm glad you brought up Syria, right? Because Aleppo, of course, is the grim example there. Michael Kaufman, what do you think about that?
Well, I certainly hope that Aleppo is not what becomes the analogy for the future trajectory of this conflict. I do think Syria, of course, is a very different type of operation. And frankly, Russian forces intervening with air power in what was a brutal civil war, in large part waged by the Syrian regime. I do feel that this conflict, as it grows to evolve, will likely see Russian forces growing frustrated. They haven't made the advances they wanted, and then switching to overwhelming use of firepower. Now, the Russian military is a force fundamentally structured as a heavy artillery-focused army. You've seen very little of that used today. And the bulk of Russia's air force has been sitting on the sidelines. Russia has hundreds of aircraft deployed in the area and attack helicopters. All that could come into play. And I shudder to think what the kind of damage that they could inflict, particularly if they're supporting troops in urban combat in those kinds of environments.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point. And Paul Stronsky, respond to that, because, you know, militaries tend to execute battles based on how they're structured, right? I mean, they're the tools that they are. And as Michael Kaufman's pointing out, if it's a heavy artillery military, I mean, is it inevitable that the level of destruction that the Russian military is willing to lay onto Ukraine, is that inevitable?
I mean, it is. It certainly looks like it's possible, and it certainly looks like that is where this is headed. But I also think, you know, we need to be aware there is, you know, a little bit of pushback inside Russia against this war. I don't think it's going to be enough to slow it down. And there's, you know, a lot of global pressure. I think, you know, Putin is increasingly feeling cornered, and that is very troubling, particularly if, you know, he chooses this route. I think we're certainly going down that path. Whether or not we'll be able to find a escape valve is unclear, but I do think it is going to be a very challenging and a big humanitarian catastrophe if this actually moves forward that way.
Can you talk to me more about that? Because how much of what you're seeing, I mean, we've had the sounds like, feels like strategic leaks of intelligence from the United States, for example, about what Putin's frame of mind might be right now. Do you take any stock in what you're hearing, and is it significant?
Well, I think the regime, the Putin regime, seems quite nervous right now, and we're seeing an intense authoritarian clamp occurring inside the country. They're now pushing a new legislation through their parliament that would declare putting out information that is contrary to official information, that is leaking information, that it doesn't support Russia's agenda, could be punishable by up to 15 years in jail. We saw a bunch of children today arrested for placing flowers outside the Ukrainian embassy. So this, to me suggests that they're nervous about domestic discontent. And we've seen some very brave Russians go out and protest this war. I also think, we've seen some soldiers. I've seen some soldiers who've been interviewed, and they don't seem to know why they're there, what they're doing. And they are, I think many of them are wondering why they have been sent in to sort of invade a neighboring country where, yes, there's been a lot of propaganda about how the current government of Ukraine is extremist and not ruled and illegitimate. But the people of Ukraine, have still been presented as sort of brotherly people. So I think there's a lot of, unknown factors here. I also think, Putin has probably, any leader, president, prime minister, after years in office, I think this is true in the United States, they live in a bubble. Mm-hmm. And I think Putin, after 20 years, is increasingly in a bubble. He doesn't recognize, that the Ukrainian people actually saw what happened in 2014, the sort of the Maidan movement as a legitimate movement. I think he is increasingly isolated. Many of the people who are now trying to solve Russia's economic problems were close advisors, 10, 15 years ago, people who were pushing Russia towards integration with the West. They've now been sort of brought back into the fold to help solve Russia's problems. But in the last couple of years, he's been increasingly surrounded himself by more hardline elements, the security services. And I think if you just look at some of the pictures of his recent diplomatic engagements, his recent meetings with government officials, they all look kind of staged. And the COVID-19 pandemic, you evidently need to, at least until this crisis, I was told by people who met with Putin that you needed to quarantine for 14 days before you even got to see him. So he seems to be very nervous. And I think he's very far removed, doesn't get the information that he probably needs to get. So I think he's badly miscalculated both on the Ukrainian resistance, but I also think on the Western resolve. I think he thought that the West was sort of a declining power, and these sanctions proved to be really quite biting. I'm even surprised at how quickly the Russian economy mm-hmm. Has tanked. I knew they were going to be harsh, but they seem to have really surprised the Russians.
So, Michael Kaufman, let me ask you to do a little analysis, not just on the sort of military movements that you're seeing in Ukraine, but about Putin's actions himself, because I think Paul Stronsky is bringing up something very, very important. Around the world, we've seen those pictures in the past few days of Putin sitting at the end of a very, very long table and not letting anyone come physically close to him. It may seem comical, but I actually don't find it very funny, because the point that Paul's making is there just a smaller and smaller and smaller circle of people around Putin advising him. Who are they, and how does that relate to what might happen or what is happening in Ukraine?
Thanks. Well, I think Paul's quite right. I think over the years, we've seen this sort of trajectory, a downward trajectory of what is a personalist authoritarian regime. And decision making in those kind of systems isn't very good. I think in recent years, as Russia's taken on this confrontation with the United States and parts of the West writ large, that the people who are sort of referenced as the the hard men, the Kremlin, but more importantly, the more hawkish views, people like Patrushev, National Security Advisor, people like Bortnikov and others, have come to dominate the conversation. And the information environment that Putin's likely dealing with is very poor. It's full of people who either share his views or perhaps even more to the right of him and more hawkish than him. And this is the kind of thing that likely led to the assumptions they were working with in launching this invasion of Ukraine in this operation, which seems to be just a terrible miscalculation, a blunder on his part, but also in their perception that, you know, the worst sanctions and opprobrium that they might be facing from the West wouldn't actually come to pass. I think they miscalculated not just in how they saw Ukrainian society. In fact, it's clear that their views hadn't evolved since 2014. That is, Ukrainian resistance and the sense of Ukrainian nationhood still doesn't occur to them that this is real, and they certainly didn't expect it here. But also how they see the West, and they likely have been operating information bubble. And the last point I will make is that a lot of folks looking at this over the past 2 years have really wondered about his mindset under COVID, and the fewer and fewer people that he's talking to, the less information that he gets, the fewer leadership engagements that he gets, the less travel he's had, and where his actual mental state is in terms of how he perceives the world, right? There are unfortunately very big question marks out there.
So if I just might offer this thesis, when that happens, when people become isolated like that, whether they're powerful heads of state or just even average people, they tend to sort of fall back on their core being. And it sounds like what we've heard throughout the hour, I'm pulling some threads here together, Vladimir Putin has demonstrated over the course of several decades that his core being is willing to fight until he gets the job done, whatever job that might be. Extreme response to avoiding humiliation. And Michael, as you said, in a war that he may himself believe he cannot afford to lose. Paul Stronsky, it seems like other than economic sanctions, which may have some impact, will political ones have any impact with a leader that has a mindset like that? Because it sounds like Vladimir Putin is in a position right now where he doesn't even care, won't care what the rest of the world thinks.
Yeah, I think he is a man who, you know, even before this latest crisis, has been fueled by paranoia. He does feel that the West is out to get him, out to overthrow him. I was in government at the State Department for many years, and I remember sitting in meetings where, you know, we were actually, you know, American officials were accused of stoking unrest and stoking protest movements across the region. So I think, he definitely, this paranoia is certainly there. I think it is quite troubling. I also think, you know, he does not believe. I mean, he once told former President George Bush that Ukraine, you know, George, Ukraine is not really a state. I think he actually believes that, and that the Ukrainian people don't have their own legitimate history. And also in his biography, you know, he grew up in the tough streets of Leningrad in the 50s and 60s. And 70s, and he said that, you know, he learned how to fight, and if a fight was inevitable, you need to punch first. And so I think, you know, these are all very troubling signs of you know, this paranoia, this deep resentment towards both the Ukraine as well as towards the West, and this, you know, this punch first and deal with the consequences later attitude that he's shown in the past.
Michael Kaufman, we have 20 seconds left. Let me just ask you, where are you going to be looking in the next 24, 48 hours to see if more escalation is on the way?
I'm going to be looking to see if they begin launching an assault on the Ukraine capital. And I'm going to be looking to see if they really open up and start using air power and heavy artillery in a number of these areas.
Well, Michael Kaufman, director of Russia Studies at the Center for Naval Analysis and author of a terrific blog called Russia Military Analysis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on your program.
And Paul Stronsky, formerly senior analyst for Russian domestic politics at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and now a senior fellow for the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Paul, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.